We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Yesterday, I mentioned this story out of Minnesota, which I think is really interesting. It's about a real successful businessman by the name of Jerry Westrum, who has now been arrested facing murder charges for a murder that took place in 1993, a really, really, really brutal murder. Not that they all aren't, but they tracked him by DNA found on a napkin that he threw away last month at, I think it was a hockey practice for his daughter. And now this guy has been arrested. Now he bonded out. He says, of course, he didn't do it. We have Edgar Linares from Minnesota, reporter up there, has been covering the story. He's going to join us here in just a short time. So I got to get to the Laura Logan stuff. Laura Logan, CBS News reporter, has covered conflicts, was on 60 Minutes. In fact, I did not know that she had left 60 Minutes. But she has not been with CBS for a month. So I don't know the backstory on that. But she's still doing reporting out there. She's covered conflicts all over the globe. I think that kind of her thing was doing some of the war correspondent overseas type of assignments. You know, whether it was, well, I think she was there when Benghazi was happening and, you know, Iraq and in the Middle East. So anyway, she is on a podcast, and I don't know who this guy is. His name is Mike Ritland. He's a retired Navy SEAL. He does a podcast, sits down with Laura, and about 2 hours, this is a pretty long conversation. I think if I looked at the video, it might even go 3 hours total. 2 hours into the conversation, he asked her about media bias. And wow, she opens up.
Maybe the best place to start is with the facts, right? You say the media is mostly liberal. Do I agree with that? Does everyone listening agree with that? What's our position on that? I agree with you. It's true. Why? Why can I say that with certainty? Well, first of all, because I've been part of this for all my life. I'm 47 now, and I've been a journalist since I was 17. And the media everywhere is mostly liberal, not just in the U.S. But in this country, 85% of journalists are registered Democrats. So that's just a fact, right? No one's registering Democrat when they're rarely a Republican. So the facts are on the side of what you just stated. Most journalists are left or liberal or Democrat or whatever word you want to give it.
Yeah, you really don't have to go any further than the facts on that, but she gets into it, and this is where I want the discussion to head. But look, the bottom line is, and as someone who has worked in media for 37 years at this point, more than 32 of those full-time professionally, the people who I've worked with in radio, in TV, that I've come across in newspapers, these are not conservative members of the media. Now, there are exceptions, clearly. You got, what, 15? Let's just even say you got 20% who might vote the other way in a given newsroom. Now, we're told that that's not supposed to make a difference, right? And Laura Logan kind of gets into this and how reporting should work. But we also know that it doesn't really work that way.
Anyone who's ever been to Israel and been to the Wailing Wall has seen that the women have this tiny little spot in front of the wall to pray, and the rest of the wall is for the men. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a great representation of the American media, is that, you know, in this tiny little corner where the women pray, you've got Breitbart and Fox News and, a few others. And then from there on, you have CBS, ABC, NBC, Huffington Post, Politico, whatever, right? All of them.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit, because I've put this into context along those lines in the past. People hear me talking about media bias. Oh, you're that conservative talk show host. You got Rush Limbaugh spewing hate every day, and that balances it off. No, Laura Logan is right. You have a couple of conservative talk show hosts. You have maybe, well, certainly now you have some conservative political publications, but the dominating media forces are still the networks. CNN, we'll put Fox in there, MSNBC, NBC, CBS, ABC, what am I missing? New York Times, Washington Post, Esquire magazine, Rolling Stone magazine. These are publications that do news stories. They feature topics about climate change, like Rolling Stone, every month seemingly, with no varied perspective, only one perspective. Now, they can do that. It's their publication. They have an agenda. But let's not try to fool everyone into this notion that the media isn't biased, because collectively they are.
We've abandoned our pretense, or at least the effort, to be objective today. The former executive editor of the New York Times has a book coming out, Jill Abramson, and she says we would do, I don't know, dozens of stories about Trump every single day, and every single one of them was negative. She said we have become the anti-Trump paper of record. Well, that's not our job. That's a political position. That means we've become political activists, in a sense, and some could argue propagandists, right? Mm-hmm. And there's some merit to that.
All right, so let's break it down locally. You have the local paper, and it's comical to me, because I had another editor do it last week on Twitter when I was criticizing their coverage, where she sends me a list of the distinguishing factors between the editorial board and the news product, which made me spit Diet Coke out of my nose, because their allegation is simply not true. The news coverage matches almost completely 100% with their editorial conflict. And they may say that there's a separation, but even if the separation exists, let's say in theory that separation exists, in practice it doesn't, because every reporter on their staff outside of Joe Holloman and maybe a couple others are whacked out lefties. They may not admit that, but they are. They've never voted for a Republican in their entire life. They've never, most of these people, and you talk about the national media, Laura doesn't get into this, but most of the people that live inside the Beltway, New York or on the West Coast, they've never been to Missouri. They've never been to rural Missouri. They don't know the issues that people in rural Missouri or Illinois deal with on a regular basis. They've never gone in the woods hunting. They've never shot a gun. All these things that may be helpful in understanding where different people are coming from. But there's no effort along those lines. So that leads to bias. Laura Logan again.
So it's bad enough that in the media we lean towards one side of the political spectrum, or we favor one ideology. But you could argue that that's just a function of the way it is, and that there's enough good journalism out there, and there's enough in, you know, accountability, that we at least get a decent representation of the truth a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I don't even see that happening today,
and
right?
And when it does, you're a fascist, or you're crazy, or...
Or how would you even know? Yeah. Because at this point, you know, the level of mistrust in the media is so high, and people really don't know what to trust anymore, yeah, what they can rely on.
Well, and that's right. And we've had examples of this from Brett Kavanaugh in the fall, where everyone was misled, or the assumption was made, Brett Kavanaugh, evil high school partier, drank beer and raped women. Let's not forget where that whole argument took us, from simple assault allegations at a party to he's a rapist. And all of the media jumped in on that narrative. Then you have the Covington Catholic situation. Then you have Jussie Smollett. I'll go back further, and let's talk about what Laura's going to address next, because I'll go back to Ferguson on some of this stuff. But let me play you what she said about when she worked at 60 Minutes.
And I remember more than once, many times, looking at someone and saying, but we're giving the impression that this is the truth, that this is what's true. Like, the way that sentence is written, or where it comes in the story, or the amount of time we're spending on this issue, it's giving people the impression that something else is true.
Now, keep in mind, when I let her continue here, I think those of you who are sharp-minded individuals, you understand the correlation here and the relevance. This is where the comment from Rudy Giuliani, sometimes the truth is not the truth, really came from. Because she sort of explains it here. Listen.
And we don't know that that's true. Or we know that's not true. Sometimes we actually do know that's not true. So we may have the fact, but the way we've used it in the story, we've been exceptionally dishonest. Sometimes intentionally, sometimes not intentionally, right? So there's lots of ways to be manipulative, or to be dishonest, or to create perception, right, without having the facts.
So let me offer some examples of that. Ferguson Exhibit A, because we didn't know exactly what happened that day when Mike Brown was laying in the street and he had been shot by Darren Wilson. But the Post-Dispatch immediately brought race into it from the very beginning with front page articles and commentary from Tony Messenger. And they never took the approach, and just look at what's happening with Jussie Smollett. They never took the approach, well, wait a second, let's maybe take a step back here before we get everyone interested in rioting and really tell the truth of what happened without opinion. They're incapable of doing that. And I made this small example of the issue of the sales tax, I'm sorry, the minimum wage last week, where we had the lawmaker on from the Springfield area who wants to make some adjustments. This was a statewide ballot issue. The Post, not only with their editorial, but also Carl Erickson, or whatever his name is, the reporter, writes this front page story. The editors make it seem like the evil Republicans are at it again. Again, 100% match with the news coverage and the editorial content. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't think so, because I know where they're coming from at the Post-Dispatch, and there's no effort. My suggestion to Carl Erickson was, hey, why not put this perspective in? There are local business owners that are affected by this, and they need to be heard. But their headline, and they did it again this afternoon, here it is: thousands of Missouri senior citizens who rent get a tax break. Lawmakers may try to end that. Well, maybe that, is that true? Is that in and of itself true? Carl Erickson did this story again. He goes through all the details here about what's going on. But look, the story is very pointed in the way it presents the story. There's no attempt to offer a different perspective on there. I could write a different headline. You know, lawmakers concerned about the abuse to the tax credit situation, or whatever the case may be. You know, how can we afford? Lawmakers raise questions about affording tax credits. But no, they lead with the social justice warrior mentality. And that's what they do at the Post. So one more cut from Laura here.
And so creating one morally defensible position, one ideological position on everything throughout your universities, throughout academia, you know, in school, in college, in academia, in media, in everywhere else, that's what concerns me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to agree with everybody, and I don't mind telling you if I don't agree with you. I'll always listen and try to understand, but I don't mind telling you. I'll be straight up. But what bothers me is not that it's the left or the right. What bothers me is that it's one ideological position, one ideological view of everything. And if you move off that narrative in any direction, you're worthless.
Look, that should concern everyone in this country. It really should concern everyone, but it doesn't. Oh man, I tell you what, a couple of big sports stories today, including the Blues hot streak hopefully continuing at, I wanted to say Scott Trey, can't say that anymore, right? Enterprise Center tonight, and then Derek Chivas's jersey being retired at Mizzou Arena. So Dan O'Neill's coming in to talk a little Blues in the next half hour. And then my buddy, Coach Norm Stewart, at 4:20 this afternoon to reflect on one of the best players he ever had in his program, the Band-Aid Man. Derek Chivas called that because he always wore Band-Aids somewhere on his body. It was kind of fun to check out where he was doing that. Yesterday, I mentioned this story I love the true crime stuff. This one was out of Minnesota, and I've been watching stuff on Netflix like the Bundy tapes, which completely fascinates me. And you have all these new things. And we talked to the guy who runs this company, GEDmatch, because they've been working with the DNA and the DNA experts out there to go back into some of these cold cases using the technology with genealogy to find killers that have been undiscovered for, in some cases, decades. So now you have a guy in a 26-year-old murder case in Minneapolis who is out of jail right now. He posted bail, but the story and the details are pretty interesting. So joining us is Edgar, and I already forgot how to pronounce his name. I was just told like 2 minutes ago. It's Linares. Is it Linares, Edgar?
Yes.
Okay, I tried. In my producer's defense, he told me like 30 seconds before he hit the air, but I have short-term and long-term memory issues. But Edgar's from our sister station in Minneapolis, WCCO. Is it like minus 75 up there right now?
Oh yeah, it is, yeah.
You know, we've had it rough down here, you know, for Missouri, but I don't even know how you get through this winter.
You know, you take the skyways everywhere in downtown, and you really just live in a coat and a thick sweater. That's how you get by the winter.
You know, I love the skyways are really cool. I think they have that in Des Moines, too. I was up there for a football game to see your gorgeous stadium when Aaron Rodgers was taken out of commission a year and a half ago, and I got to take advantage of the skyways, and that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you really can't do much outside, you know, especially when it's minus 25 degrees, and you know, get from place to place. The skyways are a, you know, lifesaver for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about
the true crime stuff.
And, yeah.
And I've been watching that HBO show. What is that? Is it called True Detective?
Yeah, True Detective is amazing.
Oh, I'm a fan of that.
Right, and me too. I watched episode 7 last night, just one more to go, and pretty intense.
I'm way behind. And I also watched the Ted Bundy stuff, too, on Netflix.
Fascinating. So, fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. So this case just falls right in line with that. I mean, 1993, Jeannie Childs, basically somebody called in a Minneapolis apartment complex. They called and noticed there was water coming in from the ceiling. And, you know, the superintendent of the building walks up there, opens the door. Sure enough, there's water everywhere. But he finds Jeannie Childs laying on the floor in just a pair of socks. And she's stabbed to death and blood everywhere. And, you know, for 26 years, nobody knows what happened. And they took some samples from, you know, some DNA samples from the bed, from a washcloth that was in the bathroom, all these kind of samples that were left behind that included Jeannie's, but also another person's. And for 26 years, nobody knew exactly who this DNA was. And they contacted that genealogy, the genealogy company, and they went ahead and just tracked it down to two individuals. Now, one of these individuals submitted a test to this genealogy website because they were saying, hey, you know, find out your genealogy.
Yeah, and I don't know if they said which one, but it could be like, I did 23andMe. It could have been 23andMe, right?
Yeah, they didn't specify exactly which company it was. All they said was a private company. So they work with them, and then sure enough brings it down to two individuals, and one of them being Jerry Westrom, who lives in Isanti, Minnesota, and he's actually a well-known businessman, has three boys, and is married, you know, and lived in Minneapolis in that time frame. In 1993, he left in December of 1993 from here, the area. And then, so they said, well, this could be the guy, so let's go ahead and track him. So that is just amazing what they're doing here, is they're following the guy around, and then they fall into a hockey game, and he decides to grab himself a hot dog, and is eating the hot dog at the concession stand while these guys are probably, you know, maybe peering around the corner or
right.
something. And they see him wipe his mouth and throw away the napkin, tosses in the trash, so he leaves. They go ahead and dig through the trash, and they grab that napkin. And sure enough, it matches the DNA left at the crime scene. So then they approach Westrom I don't know how long later, but they went ahead and approached Westrom and asked him to come in and tell him that he's part of this investigation. And they take another swab of his DNA, and they match that swab with DNA taken from the bed, which, and sure enough, it was his.
Yeah, there so was, it matched to, crazy. It matched to sperm on the comforter and the towel in the bat. The bathroom, and I guess it could not be excluded because there was some DNA on the washcloth of the toilet seat as well. But his attorney, and he did bail out, right? I said,
yeah.
So he's free right now. What are they saying? Because obviously the DNA is going to be pretty, pretty accurate. Did they say that he even knew this woman, was in the vicinity, had ever been in the apartment for another reason?
He says that he has no idea how the DNA ended up there. And his attorney, when they were leaving court, said that that this is very thin, that the evidence they have is very thin, that they don't know exactly, you know what they're trying to say here. But he's saying that he never had sex with this woman. He doesn't know who she is, that he didn't have any women, that he didn't have sex with any women in 1993 in the Minneapolis area or something along those lines. So he's just denying what happened here. But they have his DNA, and it can't be excluded.
Yeah, and see that, so what you don't want to do, and we are seeing this example kind of play out in other cities right now, is you don't want to jump on and make a decision that this guy is a killer if he really isn't a killer, because he's got this success up there and he's got a family and everything. But if the DNA matches up, there best be an example for how the DNA got there, I would think.
There was an arrest, though, in his record in 2016 that he did solicit a prostitute. So there was something along those lines, and the Hennepin County attorney, Mike Freeman, is trying to say, you know, that just shows that he did visit, you know, prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeannie Childs was a prostitute, and she used the apartment during that time. It was her boyfriend's apartment, and she used that for clients.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yep.
So what's the next step?
Well, I believe the next step is just, I don't know if they're going to take it in front of a grand jury or what's going to happen, but he is facing charges. I think he's going to be back in court. Let me see if I have it here. It doesn't say, but I assume he'd be back in court in the next month or two is when he'd be back. But that's where they're going to take it from there. They could essentially put together a grand jury. to see if there is enough evidence to go ahead. And I think they probably would have done that beforehand, though. But they could do that, or they could just ended up taking it to court.
I mean, how would you like to be? Just think of the scenario here. You know, the wife or the kids of this guy, you would have no indication seemingly that anything, we're making the assumption right now that this is, that he's guilty, but just for a moment, for the sake of argument, think about the effect that that would have on the entire family and how mind-blowing that would be.
I asked that question to Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. I said, you know, this guy, he just kind of remained quiet for 25 years, right? Well, there was that arrest in 2016, but What's really bothersome, though, is the actual brutality of the murder itself. 17 stab wounds on Childs, and some of the stab wounds actually were so deep that her intestines were showing at one point, and that the stab wounds actually continued after she was dead, is what the medical examiner reported.
But did you ask the problem? You know, the thing that jumps out there is you would think, and I just watched the Bundy tapes, but you would think that someone who has that level of violent capabilities, if in fact it was him, that would have maybe done it again,
exactly.
Too.
And I asked that, and that's why I asked that question. Yeah. You know, he's been kind of quiet, 25 years, nothing else, and nothing. Hmm. There's nothing to show that he was involved in anything else or anything similar. But who knows what could happen? I have no idea either.
I suppose you could have, I don't know how you determine guilt or innocence, but you could have a scenario. Now, he said he wasn't there, but let's say you admit, yeah, I was there. I had sex with the prostitute, but I didn't kill her.
Yeah. I thought about that too, that, one way that the prosecution could wrap this or kind of spin it is that he did have sex with the prostitute, and then he didn't kill her. He just left after that, and he doesn't know what happened afterwards.
Right.
Somebody else killed her. But he's denying that he had anything to do with it, that he was not there.
Yeah, that puts it into a different category. Edgar, really good stuff. Fascinating story. I appreciate coming on here in St. Louis.
You got it.
That's an interesting case. I don't even know what to think of it, but we'll keep tracking that for sure. 3:30, Dan O'Neill to talk a little Blues hockey coming up. And let's talk a little Blues hockey this afternoon with Dan O'Neill, the author of the bestseller, When the Blues Go Marching In. And not to be confused with his brother, Mike O'Neill, who's a friend of mine. I only say that, Dan, because every time I hear your voice, I think of your idiot brother. And I say idiot with love, you know.
It actually hurts me a little bit, Mark, because I kind of like to consider myself a friend of yours. So you always sort of make that distinction when we talk.
Yeah,
so.
Maybe I shouldn't do that. Well, I've hung around your brother a lot. That's the problem. But seriously, whenever I hear you, it's like, obviously people in the same family sound like one another, but I always think of Mike. So, maybe you're impersonating your brother. I don't know.
Well, if I am, I'm impersonating seven other...
yeah, you guys got a big family.
Yeah.
What the hell do you make of this team, Dan? This is, we had you in a couple months ago when we were in the middle of the worst part of the season. But talk about, a tale of two seasons. I don't even know how to describe it. Have you ever seen anything like this?
I don't know to this extreme. I guess there was something similar in 2002 when last time they won 10 in a row. But... the thing about it is I think they're playing now the way people sort of envisioned they would be playing when they put the team together, and they made some moves over the summer that were really widely accepted and they were commended for them. And people expected the Blues to be a good team this season, and they really had a hard time putting it together, which confounded a lot of us. And even had, I can remember probably at about the 50-game mark or whatever, people were talking about, tanking the rest of the season so they could get the number one pick.
Right.
Silly. Yeah. But, that's what makes you, I think, feel good about it is it really doesn't strike me as a anomaly, It's they've got a good team. I mean, they've got a good balanced roster. Through their top four lines, through their defense, they're getting better goaltending, but they're playing a much better brand of hockey in front of it, and that's why they're getting better goaltending. So it's really it's not like it's a freak thing. The only thing you got to worry about, Mark, is bad teams have streaks too.
Well, that's true.
And,
they do. Yeah, because, you know, even with the Cardinals last year, I remember getting to the point of August and someone said even bad teams, you know, have a run in them. And, you know, the Cardinals certainly did. I don't know if they were the worst, certainly not the worst team in baseball, but we have in St. Louis higher expectations. But that's true. That, and I said so much as that, I think, either yesterday or last week, that you have a really good team playing well right now, but we don't know how that's going to play out in the rest of March or this month.
Yeah, and I sort of responded to that before I brought it up. But As we just talked, the fact that they're playing the way that people expected them to play kind of makes you feel that this isn't freak. But, you know, I just hope there's not another shoe to drop because, for instance, they've tied their streak that they had in 2002. Well, after they won those 10 games in 2002, they won only 3 of their next 15. They tied the streak that was set earlier this year by the Buffalo Sabres, who won 10 in a row in November and went all the way to the top of the NHL standings. They were the talk of the league. And when that streak was over, they lost their next 5 in a row, and now they're in 10th place in the Eastern Conference.
Well, thanks, Debbie Downer.
Just giving you the other...
yes.
You know, I want to prepare you for anything. But no, I don't think this is... you know, a facade. I think this is a balanced team that they're playing the way that they've sort of found the way they need to play in order to be successful, that they're putting in the effort to do that. And they're getting good goaltending, and there's no reason to think that that's going to stop. Whether they win tonight or not, you know, really a more important game for them is Thursday in Dallas. But regardless, the streak's not going to last forever, but I think the way they're playing now and the roster they have, Mike.
So, you know, I think there's a lot of factors, and maybe some of this is just chemistry that develops over the course of a season that just wasn't there at the beginning of the season. But let's talk about Tarasenko. Your stars have to be playing like stars. This has been part of the problem when the Blues do get to the playoffs in the past few years, is I don't think that they have risen to that occasion. Now, you know, we've had injuries, and Tarasenko's been banged up. He had a little bit of a scare, I think, even in the game on Sunday, but when he's healthy, and I think we're seeing him be healthy finally, he's one of the best in the league.
Well, he's a difference maker. I mean, there's only one guy in the league, I think, since 2014 or 15 who has scored more goals, and that's Ovechkin. So, you know, he's the one element the Blues have that's hard, extremely hard to find and extremely hard to replace, and that's he's a sniper. He's a difference maker. And, you know, he's got 16 goals in his last 14 games. And he was sort of banged up. You know, he'd had some off-season surgery. And so how that affected him earlier in the season, you know, who's to say? The other factor, I think, without question, is they made those changes we talked about. And some of them were pretty significant. They juggled the lines up quite a bit, changed the look. And you know, for whatever reason, it just wasn't working initially. And it's taken these guys a while to figure out, I think, what works and to sort of slide into their role. So, you know, you had a guy like Braden Schenn, who was probably their top dog, you know, center last season. Well, now he's playing a secondary role. Maybe it took him a while to sort of adapt to that. Well, now he's playing on the line with Ryan O'Reilly and Tarasenko, and those guys have 16 goals during this 10-game streak and like 40 points. So they're on fire. And at the same time, other guys have sort of slid into the roles and fit what the Blues need. I mean, I really don't think people have talked a lot about Jordan Binnington, the goaltender, and he certainly has been a conduit for this with the way he's played, and Tarasenko. But it's really been a team thing. I mean, their defense is playing much better than it played earlier in the year. They've scored 17 goals, I think, since the start of the year. That's tops in the league. So they're getting everybody that's playing is contributing in the manner in which it was sort of foreseen that they were going to contribute. And that's why I think this isn't a freak thing and that you know, it makes the Blues, I think, a serious contender for the Cup.
Yeah, we've seen teams, you know, low season, the playoffs kind of go on a run, get hot at the right time. It's not one we've seen in baseball with wildcard teams, too. So you got to be playing right at the right time. Now, the question then becomes, does Craig Berube sort of secure this head coaching position if he gets the Blues to the playoffs?
Well, you know, the one thing we know for sure here, Mark, is the picture changes pretty quickly and dramatically. So sure, if you had to make that decision, are we going to rehire Craig Berube if you have to make that decision tomorrow? I mean, I don't know. I guess his chances would be pretty good. But I really think they're just going to let the season play out. He deserves all the credit in the world for changing the way they were playing, for getting them to play together and play hard together and care about it, you know, for each other and all those other cliches. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. It took a while, but that sort of change began overnight.
But you're saying clearly, you know, as someone who watches the team, that these were things that the team was just not responding to with Mike Yeo.
Yeah, they were not. They were not playing together. There was, I don't know what the issues were, but there are clearly some issues. They were playing individually. You could tell some guys just weren't happy. You know, we talked about Tarasenko. He's like a totally different player. I'll tell you another guy who hasn't gotten much credit for it. But the play of Jay Bouwmeester, which has been night and day from the first half to now, has been a huge part of their turnaround. I mean, he's playing with Colton Parayko. All of a sudden, Colton Parayko in the past 3 weeks has been a different player. Vince Dunn now all of a sudden is playing. You know, yeah, their back end has become much more solid and responsible. And I think a guy like Jay Bouwmeester has had a lot to do with that.
Dan O'Neill, who is the author of When the Blues Go Marching In, you always have book signings. Do you have any coming up here?
Not coming up soon with that book. I have a new book coming out in mid-April, Mark, on the Cardinals of the 80s. So I've been kind of busy with that. But I hope
to
line
up
some.
Cannot wait for that,
book,
man.
The hockey business wasn't real good here two or three weeks ago.
So you had to shift gears.
Hey, I got a great Norm Stewart story for you.
Yeah, share that quickly. He's coming up at 4:20 this afternoon.
Okay, when I was down at Mizzou Journalism School, it was the second semester. A junior year, so I'm starting my first experience on the Columbia Missourian as a reporter. And I come in that first week of the second semester in the morning to get, you know, find out what I'm covering and my assignments. And there's nobody around. You know, it's the sports desk. It's 10 a.m. or whatever. Nobody's around. Then the phone's ringing off the hook. So finally, you know, I think, well, I don't even really work here yet, but I guess I sort of do. So I go over and I pick up the phone and I answer it, and it's Coach Norm Stewart, who was renowned for your railing on the coverage down there, and he goes off on me for about 10 minutes, ripped me up and down, paper up and down, and I keep trying to break in. I say, well, you know, I just started it. It just went on for about 10 minutes, just devastated me, and you know. I hung up the phone and you know, I was like, well, I don't even work here yet. But
baptism
I really
by fire.
Feel like I'm a part of it.
You know, I share this story every once in a while. There was one year I was doing radio in Columbia, and at smaller market radio stations, you don't have a call screener. So you make the call and the call automatically goes on hold. And then you just take the callers as is, which is not always a great thing to do. But anyway, I'm doing the show, and it was a year that they were severely underperforming, which was not uncommon. They were supposed to be better. They barely made it into the NIT. And my position on the air was, these guys aren't good enough to even be in the NIT. And I go to the phones, and it was Norm calling me, Mark, Coach Stewart. And he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at his team. And he ripped on his team for the way they practiced. He goes, well, the little campers told me, he called them the little campers. It was like, the little campers told me they wanted to play. So the little campers are going to get a chance to play. Well, of course, they lost that game that they hosted at home. But he's a character. I love him. And he's coming up at 4:20 to talk about Derek Chivas. Great story. I appreciate it, Dan. Thank you very much. Yeah. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. Yeah, I can't wait to see the Cardinals.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Cut of the day is sponsored by the Good Feet Store, pain relief and comfort to fit any budget. We'll do a little combo deal here because first, the announcement from Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, you're going to run for president.
I am going to run for president. That's correct.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win.
That is Senator Sanders with John Dickerson on CBS.
It is unacceptable and un-American, to be frank with you, that we have a president who is a pathological liar, and it gives me no pleasure to say that, but it's true.
All right, so that's Bernie on Trump. Trump on Bernie.
Bernie Sanders is running, yeah, that's right. Personally, I think he missed his time. But I like Bernie because he is one person that, you know, on trade, he sort of would agree on trade. I'm being very tough on trade. He would tough on trade. The problem is he doesn't know what to do about it. We're doing something very spectacular on trade. But I wish Bernie well. It'll be interesting to see how he does. I think what happened to Bernie maybe was not so nice. I think he was taken advantage of. He ran great 4 years ago, and he was not treated with respect by Clinton. And that was too bad. I thought what happened to Bernie Sanders 4 years ago was quite sad as it pertains to our country. So we'll see how he does. You got a lot of people running, but only one person's going to win. I hope you know who that person is.
Well, I think the president went kind of easy on Bernie, expressed a little Bernie love there, and did not get the same treatment in return. But that's your audio cut of the day, or cuts, as the case may be. Total Information PM updates on the weather coming up.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.